Richard C. Hoagland.
So former museum space science curator, former NASA consultant, and of course during the historic Apollo missions to the moon was the science advisor to Walter Cronkite and CBS News. For the last 19 years, Hoagland has been leading an outside scientific team and a critically acclaimed independent analysis of possible intelligently designed artifacts on NASA data sets, beginning with the unmanned NASA Viking mission to Mars in 1976 and its provocative images of a region, of course, called Cydonia. In 1993, Mr. Hoagland was awarded the International Enstrom Medal for Excellence in Science by the Enstrom Foundation in Stockholm, Sweden. And for that continuing research, in the last 4 years, he and his team's investigators and investigations have been quietly extended to include over 30 years of previously hidden data from NASA, Soviet, and Pentagon missions to the moon with startling results. I'm going to do my little Walter Cronkite impression to introduce Richard C. Hoagland. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, George.
That's as good as it gets, Richard.
Oh, my gosh. Here we are, just you, me, and 20 million of our most intimate friends.
Here we are.
How does it feel?
And let me tell you, not only does it feel great, I've got to, again, thank Art for building such a base to let this rocket ship be able to fly. And part of that base has always been you, Richard, probing, investigating, all of us, accepting or not, whatever we think we will be talking about at any given time. But you've been part of that base as well. And your support over the years with Art, I think, is second to none. And I wanted you to know that.
Well, I thank you so much. You know, this is a kind of a mixed evening tonight because I'm sad that Art has tiptoed off the stage for a while. But I'm very gratified that he's got somebody like you to take the reins because, as he said many, many months ago, you get it. Now, you may not get all of it, and there's something tonight.
What do you mean I may not get all of it?
We're going to explore the boundaries of George Noory tonight, among other things.
Now, don't forget, the Noory you knew and the Noory that you're going to hear tonight are almost two different people. Don't forget, I was a guest in somebody's house.
Yes, and now you've got the chair.
I'm going to put the reins on you, Hoagland, tonight.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I'll probably end up with a broken leash or something like that.
Others have tried.
Yeah, well, they have. Hey, lots to talk about tonight. And also with your website, enterprisemission.com, have you and Lex been able to get together to see if you can work out some of those unbelievable pictures that you've been telling me about?
Actually, we have. And I would quietly advise you to get them up on your screen and reduce them down at the bottom so that we can go to them one by one by one and not have to wait for the inordinate lag because of this infernal thing called the Coast audience that seems to love to see pictures.
Oh, they love pictures.
You know, for years I used to do radio, and I loved doing radio because it wasn't television. And then Art and a guy named Keith Rowland one day had a conversation. And Keith said to Art, "Wouldn't it be neat, Art, if you had a website?" And the next thing I know, I'm doing radio and television simultaneously. And many years ago, you know how Art used to have the streaming video?
Yep.
How you could, you know, look into the studio there and see him in his various T-shirts with the cats coming in and the pictures of Crystal Gale on the wall behind him and all that. Well, when he got that set up, he called me one day and he says, "Hey, do you?" And I said, "Not over my dead body." Because, you know, doing radio, you're visually anonymous. You don't have to dress. You don't have to comb your hair. You know, you can just be an image floating in the darkness, and that's the way we're going to keep it, except for the images we show people that are not here.
Okay, we will do that. And there's also a lot going on. Let me get some of the scientific things out of the way first,
okay.
Richard. The Europeans want to go to Mars by 2025. I remember when you were with me with Zubrin many months ago, and we were talking about maybe getting somebody up there around 2015 or so. They seem to want to do this, Richard, without the United States, and I can't figure out why in the world they would do that. Why?
It's simple. Because they know we're not serious about going. Look, this is the clearest indication from the insiders, ESA, the European Space Agency, that they think NASA has been bought and sold by whoever it is that's trying to keep us from knowing any of this stuff, and they're basically putting out an ultimatum that if NASA doesn't get with the program, they're going to go and blow the whistle on all the good, neat, cool stuff that's waiting for us. This is a major straw in the wind. This is a bargaining chip. This is basically high-stakes poker for the highest stakes on the planet, which is the origins and destiny of the human species, which some of us who've been working on this for a long time think lie on Mars. And the Europeans are basically giving notice that if the NASA folks don't want to play, they're big boys now, you know, the Marshall Plan. We kind of brought Europe up to a level of our technology and then beyond, and they're going to go. I mean, this is the most important thing that we could have opened this program with, because it is a new year. 2003 is going to be catalytic, I think, in some of these areas, as I said to Art on our last show together last Friday. And I believe that this is a kind of a throwing down the gauntlet by the Europeans to notify NASA and this administration, if you don't get with it, we're going.
Well, why in the heck are we spending all this money sending these probes to Mars if we don't have any plans to send a man there?
That's a very good question. I mean, there are those who would argue that the probe element is because of JPL, which is kind of probe central for NASA, robot central, has taken over spaceflight, except for low Earth orbit, and is basically running the show. They have insisted for years that the reason that NASA will not come clean on the question of life and artifacts and a bunch of the other stuff we're going to talk about tonight is because basically JPL would lose its control, and in any rush to send men and women to Mars, they would be relegated to a kind of a backwater and no longer be in the driver's seat. Well, I happen to absolutely, totally, unqualifiedly, is that a word?
Yeah. If you say it, it becomes.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a word.
I think that theory has more holes in the Titanic. Because what you need to do, and we're going to probably do a piece on Enterprise on this, you know, we've just done a very intensively researched scholarly piece that we're going to talk about later, and I think that we need to do another one, which basically goes back to the early history of the U.S. space program and demonstrates how, if it had not been for the manned mission to the moon, Apollo, JPL would be nowhere. JPL's whole raison d'etre before and after the Kennedy announcement was like night and day. Before Kennedy said we're going to the moon, JPL had a very limited leash and a much more limited budget to send a few tiny fledgling probes to the moon and one out toward Venus.
Right.
After the Apollo missions were announced, they suddenly got the floodgates open, the money started flowing. They got all kinds of bucks to build all kinds of robots to basically go and make sure that the moon was safe to land Neil and Buzz on. And the same thing would happen if we announced a manned mission to Mars. Instead of being relegated to some backwater, JPL would be front and center, because you know that the Congress and the President and the American people would not commit astronauts until we had practically mapped and sampled every square inch of Mars.
Sure.
You're going to do that with robots. So this idea that the cover-up is masterminded by people at JPL who don't want the Houston boys, the manned spacecraft boys, to take control is ludicrous, again measured by the science of the history that is available. Anybody who can do a Google search, look into the history of NASA, look at the NASA History Office, look at the charts, look at the numbers, and just see what happened to JPL when Apollo was announced. It would happen again. So if that's not the reason why they're not gung-ho, there's got to be another reason. And the other reason takes us deep into that fabled land called Conspiracyville.
If you were running NASA right now, and you had a blank check.
Oh, boy.
And hiring and firing power, without giving me names, because nobody's going to know really who they are anyway.
Uh-huh.
What would you do?
I would streamline the process and make it much more democratic. There needs to be much more oversight of what NASA does. The reason that NASA has been able to get away with what it has over the last 30, 40 years, which is basically go and explore space and keep the really cool stuff to themselves, is because nobody outside of NASA really gives a damn. except a few congressmen and senators on the Hill who basically lobby and argue at every budget cycle that, you know, some of that money be spent in their district, you know, the ultimate fork. But outside of that, you know, the influence of the people that really care or should care has been kept as minimal as possible. In fact, one of the ways that we have incurred the wrath of a lot of folks at NASA is when Art and I would, you know, incite this extraordinary audience, the most interesting, intelligent audience, I think, in the history of radio, day or night, to get actively involved. Because when they got involved, and they've sent those tens of thousands of faxes to NASA headquarters, to the various networks with copies to various politicians on the Hill, things have happened.
Yes, you're right about that.
They don't want that to happen. They don't want to democratize space. They don't want to get people excited. They want their basic $15 billion a year, port, you know, kind of moving quietly along, which gives them the cover to do whatever they really are doing without really much public accountability, except an occasional article here and there to the InsideSpace.com crowd.
Do you not trust them?
No. After all that we've been through? Of course not. The NASA that currently exists is no more, bears no more relationship to the NASA that I grew up with, that I idolized, that I worked for a while. I was a consultant, as you know.
Yes.
Then, you know, the current White House bears to the White House of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. They're two totally separate animals and should be viewed as such.
Do you think NASA has lost its luster, Richard, from those glory days? Because I remember as a kid, I mean, I loved the initials. And that's all. I wanted to be an astronaut. I mean, every kid my age wanted to be an astronaut. We loved that phrase, NASA. That's changed now.
It really has. And I want to talk a bit tonight about, you know, why it has. And I got an extraordinary gift at Christmas. Robin gave me a time machine.
Oh, yeah. Come on.
Art having this conversation because Art is head over heels for time machines. Robin gave me actually three of them.
Three time machines.
I don't know where she found them, but she found three pristine copies of the old science fiction magazines from the 50s and early 60s.
Uh-huh.
That I used to read, and then, you know, for the time I actually wrote for some of them.
Yeah.
And what's astonishing is I open the pages up, and the first thing that hits you is, you know, the price. 35 cents for a magazine? I mean, you know, you multiply everything by a factor of 10 to get to today's value.
Exactly.
Then you look at the books. $4 for a book, all right, $3.95. But what's eerie is that I looked in the back in the book review section, and there are guys that I initially idolized, and then we became friends. People like Fred Pohl and Arthur C. Clarke and G. Harry Stein, and I started reading some of the reviews of their work and what they had put out, brand new, pristine, on the marketplace back, you know, 40, 50 years ago, and believe me, it is very clear from reading this, and it's been an extremely interesting journey, literally a kind of a journey back in time. It's clear that something changed, that the vision and the dreams and the imagination exemplified by those pages and those writers no longer is out there. Something has happened. I mean, you said a moment ago, has NASA lost its way? Well, no, lost means that you've been trying your damnedest and you just couldn't make the grade.
Right.
Someone has subverted this vision, this dream. That's my contention based on the evidence. And as we're going to get into the details of this recent paper that we wrote, we have now documented meticulously how that dream and that vision has been subverted. And the big question of the night is going to be, when we get through that process, why? Why did they do this? What happened to basically seduce a whole bunch of engineers who wanted to go to space and give it to all of mankind as their heritage? What happened to those people where some of them or most of them still think that's what they're doing, but when people look at it from the outside, that bears no more resemblance to that than, you know, the Russian program used to bear to a democratized effort to really explore space on behalf of all the Russian people.
Is it possible, Richard, that this is merely what we see, some kind of cloak, and the real mission, the underlying mission, is something that's going on deep within NASA?
George, I think you have put your finger right on the central question. I have long resisted the idea that what we see as NASA is window dressing.
Yes.
That it merely is a show for the benefit of those too damn dumb to realize they're being had. But the more I look at the data, the more I look at the evidence, the more homework I do, and the more puzzle pieces I put together, I am slowly coming to the conclusion that the $15 billion we're spending in NASA is basically window dressing. It's not the real space program. The real space program is being run by other folks, maybe even with other technology, maybe even from another continent, for purposes that the American people haven't a clue about. And I think one of the major reasons why we've had such incredible furor and controversy and acrimony and bitter accusations over the infrared image that we were leaked this summer is because I was told by some of my sources that this is the real data that the real program is getting, and the stuff coming out of ASU and NASA and you know, the public affairs versions of it are basically window dressing to conceal the real program. In fact, at one point in the conversation, one of the chief engineers, the computer guy,
yes,
from ASU, Arizona State University, Noel Gorelick, who this summer was a daily frequenter of the Enterprise mission website and the conference and the chat rooms, he was asked by somebody anonymously, you know, because that's the way those boards are, whether he could be have been duped to the extent that he was getting copies of data, but the real data was going someplace else. And he gave a very interesting answer that it was theoretically possible, but unlikely. And within hours, the people who control that website took that comment and vanished it into the ether. There's no record that that comment ever was made. I'm hoping that maybe somebody in this audience actually, you know, logged it or recorded it, because it was a very interesting insight by an insider into the possibility that what you raised, George, is exactly what's been going on, that for the last 40 years, maybe 30 years, depending upon how long you want to give the honest guys to get their heave-ho, we have been living a schizophrenic space program where the real stuff gets to people that never talk to us about what's really out there.
Merely an image. Well, we're going to continue our chat. Richard C. Hoagland, my guest. By the way, you might want to go up to my website at coasttocoastam.com and start looking at some of these pictures that Richard is going to talk about tonight. You're going to find them all, because that's a brand new website for a lot of you. You're going to find those pictures on the right-hand side of the screen, and just start clicking all those little Mars pictures and start taking a look at them and get ready. Lots more to talk about with Richard C. Hoagland. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with my guest Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, this week China has announced that they want to send a man up into space. They plan to do it sometime around mid-2003. They seem to be having a lot of luck getting their rockets up there in space. Is that coming by any accident, or could they be using a little U.S. technology there?
Actually, they're using a little Russian technology. Their Shenzhou spacecraft is a kind of a Chinese version of the Russian Soyuz. which mm-hmm. is a well-traveled, well-designed, you know, definitely a well-rehearsed spacecraft.
That's a big rocket, isn't it?
Well, it's not the rocket, it's the actual vehicle in which the astronauts or cosmonauts or I'm not clear on what the Chinese are going to call their space persons, but we do know, the CNN report said they're going to be experienced jet fighter pilots drawn from the ranks of the nation's Air Force, which, of course, is what we did back in the Mercury days. China's following in the steps, you know, that we did and the Russians did in terms of, you know, launching first into low Earth orbit. And but they have an awful lot of other technology now to build upon because there's this incredible miniaturization which has taken place since 1957, since October, when the Russians launched the first satellite. And so we're going to see a much diminished timeline. In other words, the things that we did that took decades...
Right, with all our trial and error.
...are going to be compressed into a much tighter timeline, and I think you're going to see the Chinese more adventurous for a couple of reasons. One is they have pressures. You know, they definitely need the economic infrastructure that space can give them because feeding all those billions of mouths is very, very difficult. And number two, because of the numbers of people in China and the fact that there is a forcing function to compete with the West, I think you're going to see them cut some corners that we certainly don't want to do, and the Russians were very negative about doing. And so I think you're going to see some remarkably interesting things coming out of China beginning in the second half of this year.
Do you trust the Chinese, Richard?
It's not a matter of trust. It's a matter of the kind of celestial landscape. I mean, you have to ask yourself, why are the Chinese interested in space? What could possibly interest a country which is basically, as I said a moment ago, desperately concerned with feeding itself?
Defense.
But defense is not really attainable from space. We looked at this decades ago, back when, you know, Kennedy and was coming in and Eisenhower was going out. We now know because of a lot of declassified documents that there were studies by the Army, for instance, Project Horizon, of putting missiles on the moon. And it was eventually ruled out because of very practical engineering and scientific reasons. The several days delay in getting missiles back from the moon would mean that by the time they got here, everything would be over. So the old-fashioned ICBMs in silos is basically the way, if you want to be a strategic power and you want to, you know, maintain a parity with the other superpower or superpowers on the planet, that's the way to go. Putting men in space is not a military advantage in any reasonable way, shape, or form. Before the show, you and I had this brief conversation about if they were up there, could they do mischief to our satellites?
Yeah, and because I think that would be their intent. I really do.
But it's so much easier to shoot them down with a laser from the ground. You had a caller on, you know, during the first hour who was talking about the X-ray laser.
Yes.
And the fact that
yes.
technology, according to his sources, may have matured, because I've been following that myself, and I remember when Edward Teller proposed it. And the problem is that you had it's very hard to make a workable X-ray laser. Very difficult. It's because X-rays are such incredibly high energy and tiny wavelengths, they don't reflect off mirrors the way light does or radio waves. So getting them harnessed so they all march in step in one direction, which is the hallmark of a laser, is very, very, very difficult. And if someone, in fact, has created the technology to manage that using, you know, plasmas or atomic accelerators or whatever, it will be much cheaper to keep those on the ground and simply aim them at the sky and take pot shots at whatever you don't like. So even if they don't go for those exotic technologies, even ordinary lasers or particle beams or things like that, aim from the ground is where you have no power limitations and no weight limitations and no basically technology limitations. If someone wants to basically do nasty stuff in space, you can do it from the Earth unless you're talking about space which is far beyond low Earth orbit, in which case then you're talking a totally new ballgame, which is inheriting the solar system. You're talking, you know, playing out there with the big boys for the real prizes, which in our minds are ancient ruins on the moon and Mars and high technology that might be sequestered and brought back and reverse engineered and figured out and used. That's where going to space gives you the advantage. And if that's what the Chinese are doing, what I see will happen is it will be a more healthy competition with the two clubs that already have a closed shop on the issue, which is basically us and the Soviet Union, a.k.a. Russia now.
But do you think if they play around with our satellites, and let's look at my theory for a moment, they send up a Chinese knot or whatever they're going to call them, and they do screw around with satellites, is that an act of war?
Well, it would be incredibly obvious. It'd be incredibly stupid because, you know, a spacecraft carrying men is not exactly invisible, and launches can be tracked, and everybody would know, oh, the Chinese launched something, oh, it's closing in on a DMSP satellite. Oh, the satellite went dark. Now, what do you suppose could have done? Well, the Chinese were there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like leaving fingerprints all over it. If you're going to do something, I mean, you got to also ask yourself, what would be the purpose? The purpose of doing something with satellites, basically reconnaissance satellites, would be to blind your adversary that you were going to do something really mean and nasty. But because we have so many satellites up there and so many redundant, you know, systems, you'd have to blind a lot of them, and that in itself would be a giveaway that something was coming. We actually are probably alive on this planet, George, because of the capabilities of reconnaissance from low and high Earth orbit. Years ago, when I was with CBS and we had just landed on the moon, I walked across the street with my friend Arthur Clark, and we went to a little film company which was doing a program on the benefits of space, and I was asked to help write the script. And one of the things that I did was to research the impact of the reconnaissance satellite on the stabilization of the Cold War, East versus West. And I was able to prove, not only to myself, but to everyone involved in the project, that without those spy satellites, you know, Corona and the KH series and the others, we would probably not be having this conversation, because they so stabilized both sides to know what the other guys had and what they were doing, that it is inconceivable now that anybody would willingly destabilize that system. And if they did, it would be the big tip-off that they were planning something pretty nasty and appropriate steps would be taken. Because remember, this is not like terrorists. China is a big country with lots of people in big cities with coordinates known down to the foot.
Well,
it's much easier to deter countries, nation-states, from doing nasty things than it is Bedouins wandering around the planet, you know, skulking around from cave to cave.
Well, when you talk about nasty things, you know, earlier you mentioned NASA's budget, $15 billion. Do you know that Bush is estimating that if we go into Iraq, for example, now you look at the differences, $15 billion budget for NASA, at least what we can see, right?
Yep.
They think that this Iraqi war, if it occurs, is going to cost $50 to $60 billion. Well, probably double that, because they never get that right. But look at the inconsistencies. I mean, here we have the... I mean, we could go to Mars.
To Mars for what he's going to spend on this war.
Absolutely.
Which, of course, is ironic, because Mars is the god of war. And as I was discussing with Art the other night, and I want to come back to that in this program, there appears to be some interesting elements that conceivably connect this obsession that this administration has with Iraq and Saddam Hussein with some of the things that we have looked at, namely the progenitors of the human species and connections to ancient cities and civilizations and former species on Mars, and how it all winds up in these ancient mythologies of a place called Sumer, which is modern-day Iraq.
Well, yes, it is. Yes, it is. Modern-day Iraq. Now, of course, which is what Zechariah Sitchin, Richard, has written about for some time. Do you know? Is he?
Yeah,
not?
He was one of the first to do an actual scholarly treatment of these cuneiform tablets, which have the creation myths, the Enuma Elish, which is the most famous of the Sumerian creation myths, and the record of what happened before the flood and after the flood, and, you know, when kingship was lowered from heaven, and all of these somewhat allegorical descriptions, which Sitchin, in his scholarship, was the first to claim were not allegorical, were in fact literal, and simply not comprehensible by Western science. You know, what's really eerie is I'm actually sitting here looking through one of these magazines I described a little while ago, and in the 1957 issue, March of 57, speaking of Iraq and Sumer,
yes,
there is a book review of a very famous Sumerologist. Here's the book. It's called From the Tablets of Sumer by Samuel Noah Kramer.
And when was that published?
March 1957. Remember, this is pre-space age.
Before
October, when the Russians scared the pants off everybody with the satellite, Sputnik. Listen to this. Until 100 years ago, this review says, no one had ever heard of Sumer or Sumerians. That they are now known to have been unique in many aspects is due to the fastidious labors of specialized archaeologists known as Sumerologists. Dr. Kramer takes a humorous view of his calling, referring to himself as a pinpoint historian, concerned with the history of a tiny triangle of land formed by the Tigris and Euphrates rivers only up to the time of Alexander the Great. The Sumerians had evolved a high civilization as early as 3000 BC, with many historical firsts. They organized the first schools, literary debates, library catalogs, assembled the first pharmacopoeia, farmer's almanac, and bicameral congress, and achieved the first recorded case of tax reduction. As you can see, a truly remarkable people. Now, that review is in literally this little piece of time machine that I was given for Christmas.
That's great. Almost 50 years ago.
Incredibly appropriate, because history now comes full circle. Before the space age, Kramer's book, which basically made the Sumerians a household word, he kind of did for Sumer what Carl Sagan did for Cosmos.
Uh-huh.
And now we're going to war with the descendants of the people who gave us civilization on this entire planet. And the question has got to be, why?
Well, I don't know why, Richard. I mean, a lot of people have their own thoughts and their own theories. I'm sure you have yours, don't you?
Well, as I was saying to Art the other night, and looking at this, it appears that we're plumb smack dab in the middle of this problem of the conspiracy. You know, we have found that NASA is not only hiding stuff, but the stuff that they do in a very strange way.
But are you saying that we're going to take out Saddam because he knows something that NASA wants covered up?
That was where Art was going. I don't actually think that's the case. I mean, I would actually love it if he'd found something. We do know that he has been assiduously rebuilding and excavating an awful lot of ancient sites.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
Himself is the reincarnation of the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, and the Babylonian kingdom and the Akkadians and the Assyrians were all lineal descendants, grading one into the other, of the original Sumerian civilization. So he's definitely living as if he was a reincarnated god king on earth.
He has built his own Tower of Babel, hasn't he?
That's actually, I think it's a communications tower. You know, it holds modern TV and satellite transmissions.
Sure looks like one, though.
But, you know, form follows function. So he's at least assembling the historical antecedents in a certainly interesting way. But the point I'm trying to make is that if you start looking at what NASA does, even the stuff that we see, we found from our years of research, follow an extraordinarily weird ritual. For a sectarian scientific process, they're doing things, according to, and for lack of a better term, I'll use the word astrology, although that's not really it. They launch when certain stars are at certain angles above the horizon, both at the launch site, Cape Canaveral, and they arrive on planets or fly by planets and download images. when other stars are at certain angles above the landing sites on Mars or the Moon or Europa or any other place they're looking at. They download images when those stars are at the same angles over JPL, and we have documented over and over and over again, and it's on our website, enterprisemission.com, and we've got tons and tons of articles and stories that have basically put facts on this framework. We even had a mathematician, Mary Weaver, many years ago. She worked for Boeing, and she volunteered to do the math, and she actually worked up a paper that looked at the probabilities that these alignments, as they are called, were due to chance. And her conclusion, based on not only the Apollo program data and some of the Viking data, but going back to the early years, pre-Apollo, with the unmanned missions, where JPL was totally in charge of those missions, she came up with a number of trillions to one against this being simply chance. So when you document, as we have, that there is this strange ritual behavior, and then you find that that behavior is linked to an ancient Egyptian religion, which we have, and then you realize that Egypt, as a rising superpower along the Nile, was the antithesis and competitor and enemy of the ancient Sumerian civilization over in the Tigris-Euphrates, you begin to see that there is a potential for a modern reiteration of history, that what we have is an Egyptian mythology confronting a Sumerian mythology. Saddam thinks he's the reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar, and God knows what George Bush thinks he's the reincarnation of, but he's acting like a damn Egyptian pharaoh. And throwing the weight of the last remaining superpower on Earth into the breach in the vague premise that this guy, this evil, terrible, bad guy, has awful, horrible weapons that are going to eliminate all of us, where half a world away, North Korea, has literally thrown out the UN watchdog team this week and is blithely going ahead with producing weapons-grade plutonium and is bragging about it.
And you know what? Nobody's doing anything about it. They're literally pushing us around.
If this doesn't tell someone somewhere at some time, all is not as you have been told.
Well, speaking of that, we're going to find out why Richard is so concerned about the true colors of NASA. And get over to my website and take a look at some of the pictures that he has given us at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back in a moment. Don't touch that dial. You got the juice of the Hydra upon you. Your dirty sweet, you're my girl. Get it on. Bang a gong. Get it on. Get it on. Bang a gong. Get it on. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie, along with Richard C. Hoagland. Okay, Richard, we need to direct people to coasttocoastam.com and have you give us a few little instructions on what we're looking for and why, because you've come up with another fascinating theory here. Let's go for it.
Well, I'll tell you, before we get to that, I wanted to finish up with Bush, because I have this, shall I say, insight that I want to share with folks.
All right, this is unusual, a little political twist coming from you, Mr. Hoagland?
Well, look, if this means anything, if the pursuits that we've been doing for the last 20 years, looking at things on Mars, has any, you know, reality, any grounding in where we all live, or as my trucker friends used to say, where the rubber meets the road,
yeah,
it's got to come back to us. It's got to come back to Earth. It has to somehow explain or amplify or ameliorate or give us some insights into why we're doing things on this planet then that don't seem to make any sense. And you'll see quickly what I mean by that. I've been reading, I was given another book at Christmas. This was a nice Christmas for books. This is one by Bob Woodward called Bush at War, which was published this fall, or last fall, actually. And he had two full interviews You know who Bob Woodward is, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
Woodward,
absolutely.
Bernstein, Watergate.
Yep, the Watergate,
you know,
Nixon boys.
Well, Robert Redford and what was the other
Dustin
guy?
Hoffman. Dustin Hoffman.
Dustin Hoffman, good old Dustin Hoffman, in a very interesting movie. In fact, what's interesting, what's incredibly ironic, is that when RKO signed us to do our film, our movie on all of this,
yes,
they compared what we were going to try to do with All the President's Men, which was the book written by Woodrow Bernstein about the investigation of Watergate that brought down the president. So Bob Woodward is definitely an insider. And when he writes anything, you should pay attention. Like many others in our society today, he seems to be saying things sometimes directly and sometimes between the lines. And I would strongly recommend to anybody who wants to figure out what George is up to, the other George, you get Bush at War by Bob Woodward, and you will have some other insights. And I'm going to share with you one right now. Quoting Woodward, he says, "I wanted to attempt to understand the president's overall approach or philosophy to foreign affairs and war policy following 9/11. The Taliban had been deposed, but possibly Bin Laden, and certainly many of the Al-Qaeda network had escaped. Other terrorist attacks were expected." Remember, this was the fall of last year.
You're right.
"The United States now had some 7,000 troops on the ground in Afghanistan, which was still a dangerous, unstable place. Karzai was in continual jeopardy," that's the provisional president of Afghanistan, "even with American special forces acting as his bodyguards. The theoretical pronouncements Bush had made about not nation-building had been discarded almost wholesale in the face of the need to keep Afghanistan together. He was at times acting like the Afghan budget director and bill collector. Quote, if I've asked once, I've asked 20 times. I want to see the cash flow projections of the Afghan government," Bush said. "Who owes money? I wrote a letter the other day dunning these people over in Europe for money. He learned it only costs $500 a year to pay a trained Afghan soldier." Bush, "I said it makes no sense to train people for a military and then not pay them." Until that day in Crawford, here's where it gets interesting. Woodward, "until that day in Crawford, I had not heard the sweeping aspirations Bush has for his presidency and the United States. Most presidents have high hopes. Some have grandiose visions of what they will achieve, and he was firmly in that camp. Quote, I will seize the opportunity to achieve big goals, Bush told me, as we sat in a large room in his home in Crawford with the breeze comfortably blowing in through the screens. There is nothing bigger than to achieve world peace. Action was not just for strategic purposes or defensive purposes, he said. You see, it's like Iraq. Condi," that's Condoleezza Rice, his national security advisor.
Yeah.
"Condi didn't want me to talk about it." He and Rice, who was sitting with us during the interview, laughed. "But wait a minute," he continued, "just as an aside, and we'll see whether this bears out. Clearly, there will be a strategic implication to a regime change in Iraq if we go forward. But there's something beneath that, as far as I'm concerned, and that is there is immense suffering." Bush glanced at Rice. "Or North Korea," he quickly added. "Let me talk about North Korea." But he seemed to mean Iraq. Iraq, North Korea, Iran were the axis of evil he'd identified in his State of the Union speech. The president sat forward in his chair. I thought he might jump up as he became emotional, speaking about the North Korean leader. "I loathe Kim Jong-il," Bush shouted, waving his finger in the air. "I've got a visceral reaction to this guy because he's starving his people. I've seen the intelligence of the prison camps. They're huge. He uses them to break up families, to torture people. I'm appalled." I asked if he'd seen the overhead satellite photography of the prison camps provided by U.S. intelligence. "Yes, and it appalls me." He wondered how the civilized world could stand by and coddle the North Korean president as he starves his people. "It's visceral," Bush said. "It's my religion. Maybe it's my... but I feel passionate about this." Now, this is curious, George.
You know, by the way, of all these years...
passionate about North Korea...
Richard, let me ask you this real quickly. Of all the years that I've known you, this is the first time I have heard you so passionate about an event like this that is non-science. I can't wait to hear the rest of this. Go ahead.
It's because it makes no sense. Here is a guy who rose, the leader of North Korea, a guy who has now flaunted his armed forces and tweaked his nose at the UN, thrown out the investigators, basically is going ahead with a nuclear weapons program. Bush has on the record said he can't stand this guy. He's doing horrible non-humanitarian things to his own people, starving them, setting up prison camps to deliberately divide families. And yet, he is ignoring what's going on there and focusing his sole attention on Iraq. To me, the reason this is interesting is because if we hadn't found this deep Egyptian ritual connection between things going on in this government, in NASA and in other agencies, and then found, of course, very obviously, the Sumerian connection with Iraq and Saddam, it wouldn't make any sense. But when you stand outside the box, when you look at it from the perspective of this audience, which has had so many years of looking at normal events they see on CNN from a slightly different perspective, It, as I said to Arthur the other night, it's the only thing to me that makes sense. Iraq has got to be, in this year, 2003, the focus, because it happens to be the year in which, for the next and last 73,000 to 75,000 years, Mars comes closer than at any other time. If there is a ritual, religious undercurrent to this conflict, I mean, look, Mars is the god of war, right?
Yeah, well, Richard, maybe it's because Iraq has oil and North Korea doesn't.
Yes, but North Korea has nuclear weapons and Iraq doesn't.
I agree with
that. And the excuse is he's dangerous, he's used them on his own people. Well, what dictator hasn't? Give me a break, all right? And we gave them all the stuff that he used anyway. We sold it to him back during the previous administrations. There is something untoward in this rush toward the inevitable. And what bothers me is that an awful lot of American boys and men and women are going to die. An awful lot of Iraqis are going to die. And for what? To satisfy a ritual?
Well, I don't know if that's it or not, Richard. That's quite a theory on that. I do agree with you that we should be concentrating first on North Korea. They're the ones that are rattling their saber sword. They're the ones that have the ability, I think, to inflict damage on this planet. And we seem to want to work something out with them diplomatically. They're the insane ones. They're the ones that are threatening to kill every American that walks across the DMZ.
Well, just read George's own words in this interview. He can't stand Kim Jong-il. And yet, Colin Powell sits on the Sunday talk shows and says, oh, we can handle this diplomatically. There's no need to. And on the other side of the planet, I mean, with a guy who is at least as equally insane, if not Machiavellian, you know, we are determined to focus our attention on Iraq. Now, remember, Iraq doesn't really have the oil. It has a little. The real oil prize is Saudi Arabia. And we have enough basing and enough agreements with the Saudis to prevent anything that Saddam could do from disturbing the oil. I mean, during the Gulf War, he set fire to what, 600, 700 oil wells?
In Kuwait, and there's word that he's going to blow up his own if something happens.
And what did we do? We put them out in record time. I was involved with an engineer who had a remarkable new technology that he was quietly trying to shop around to the DOD.
Wasn't Red Adair hired to go out there?
Red Adair was hired, and, you know, you saw the John Wayne movie where basically you use dynamite, or nitroglycerin, I guess, to blow the well and to create a vacuum. And what it does is it puts out the fire by starving it for fuel, for oxygen. And then you have to cap the well. I mean, incredibly dangerous work. And they had projected it would take them something like 10 or 15 years using that technique to cap all those wells and put out all those fires. Well, they did it in 6 months.
That
I mean, I may be
fast,
off by
yeah.
a month or two, but they did it in incredible record time because they had to. And they invented new technologies. The point is that nothing that Saddam could do could threaten the American oil supply under the Saudi sands to the level that requires us to put so many American men and women in harm's way when, on the other side of the planet, we've got guys with not only nuclear weapons, the North Koreans, but you know that the North Koreans are building the rockets that Saddam is buying?
Yes.
So they have the delivery system.
That's right.
Saddam does not have a delivery system unless he puts it in a freighter, in which case, you know, bin Laden or any other two-bit terrorist is as much of a problem.
Well, maybe they figure Saddam's going to topple quickly, and then we can rush everything over to North Korea.
Yeah, but then you have the problem of nation-building in Iraq. You have the problem of disillusion. You have the problem of instability, that terrible word that Washington hates to use.
And you've got to feed millions of people.
None of this makes sense. As I said, you know, my job, as I see it, because Enterprise is a very diverse investigation, looking at the scientific, at the socioeconomic, at the religious, at the ritual, you know, is to try to create or to discern some coherence in something which even the mainstream, I mean, if I have seen one show with Chris Matthews and O'Reilly and the others, I've seen, you know, 1,000. Nobody, none of the mainstream pundits can figure out why with a rock basically sitting there as a sitting duck with inspectors all over it, and North Korea throwing them out and proudly proclaiming it's going to go ahead with a viable program, why we're not focusing on North Korea.
I know. It makes no sense. And
so
still,
when Sherlock Holmes, you know, remember his maxim, when you have eliminated the possible, you have to go for the impossible. And my suggestion is that the undercurrents for what we're seeing in this year of 2003 has to do with Mars and the connection of Mars and Sumer and Iraq with the genesis of the human species and its possible emigration from the red planet.
Well, if all that is true, we're going to have to put Saddam and George W. under hypnosis, a little regression, and find out who they were in a past life, Richard.
Or who they think they were.
Or who they think they were.
And I promise you, George, it's going to get weirder. You know, we have not seen the end of this weirdness. If the mainstream commentators cannot figure it out, you know, if they can't come up with a plausible explanation, you know that something really bizarre is going on.
Well, and I'll tell you this. I mean, we were supposed to give our UN weapons inspectors specific coordinates of where we believe some of these weapons of mass destruction are.
Yep.
I don't think we've done that, have
we? Because we don't have it. I don't think we've got a damn thing. It's all smoke and mirrors because we have to have the war. And when you start doing, look, we are the last 800-pound gorilla on the planet.
Well, explain this to me again, though. Because Mars is going to be so close than the past 70-some thousand years,
yep.
What does that have to do with going into war?
It's all symbolic. All religion, George, for the believer is symbolism to the nth degree. I mean, for the believer, the symbolism is real. For those outside, it's merely symbolism. When you're trying to catch a criminal in your FBI, remember back during the sniper problem,
mm-hmm.
when they had every profiler who had ever worked for the Bureau sitting on some talk show?
Oh, they were all working double time.
Trying to figure out what these guys were up to.
Or who they were?
Not only who they were, but their modus operandi. Their, you know, to get inside their heads, to figure out, I mean, that's what profilers do. There's a very, very, very famous profiler. I forget her name. She's an FBI agent that Art has interviewed a couple of times. I think her name is Candace. Don't remember her last name.
Yeah, you're right.
She was involved with the Ted Bundy situation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they basically tried to figure out from his manifesto and, you know, the bombs and the other bits and pieces of information what this guy was doing, what was driving him. Well, we've got to figure out what's driving this, you know, immovable object toward this irresistible force. To have a war in the dawning moments of the 21st century when there's no need, when we can do it other ways. I mean, if Saddam is as hated by his people as we have been led to believe...
Well, and I think he might be. I do.
Well, I definitely do, too. Then if you look at the story that Woodward lays out of how we subverted the Taliban by basically spreading lots of money, the CIA went in and basically bought every tribal leader and every warlord in sight. And they, with $70 million, they basically saved tens of thousands of lives because we didn't have to kill those people. We simply bought them and put them on the books. There's got to be people in Iraq, which is a much more sophisticated, westernized country, who will, with some modicum of help, begin a serious program to destabilize the system from within and take control when Saddam falls without invading a city and engaging in the most suicidal, primitive concept of urban warfare in the 21st century. Infantryman, you know, against sniper, down alleys with innocent civilians in between. I mean, it's awful to contemplate. And for what? Because he possibly has something nasty, and yet we don't know where it is, so we can't tell the inspectors, go there and you'll find it? Something.
I'll tell you, Richard, this is one of the most bizarre theories I've heard. You gotta admit that.
But bizarre doesn't make it untrue.
Well, no, I'm not going to say it's
untrue. Any theory has to be gauged by its predictability. And the predictability of this is that we have to go to war in 2003, and that once we topple Saddam, we will be there to own whatever it is that is viewed as either realistically valuable or symbolically valuable. And that introduces a whole series of other problems because, of course, remember, the Islam world, the billion or so Muslims, will view this as another crusade. In fact, there was a cover. I'm trying to think of what magazine. My friend George, another George, did an article, which I'm going to be reading very carefully, called The Robbing the Cradle of Civilization, which is another perspective on this whole problem. And he found a remarkable cover. And I'm scanning down here, not the Newsweek. It's
maybe they're after the Ark of the Covenant or
National
something
Review.
Tucked away.
It was the December 3rd issue, 2001 National Review. It has George Bush sitting on a white horse with mail and his tunic and a shield. And it says, here we go again, Islam and the West. And he's carrying a pennant with the red crosses, which, of course, were the famous Templar crosses from the Hospitallers from the Middle Ages.
Hold that thought, Richard. Richard C. Hoagland. Ooh, that's a different kind of a theory. And don't forget to get ready to go to my website, because we're going to talk about some true colors of NASA. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Yeah. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Richard C. Hoagland. Richard, you had an opportunity to talk with my new webmaster, Lex Lonehood, tonight, I trust?
I certainly did.
Excellent. Excellent. I'm glad
before
you
we get to the images,
each other.
Don't you love this?
Well, hurry up before we lose airtime here, Richard.
My friend George Haas did this thing on the history of Sumer and how it might relate to this, and I haven't had a chance to go through his entire paper, but we're probably going to wind up linking it to Enterprise because he has done an extraordinary yeoman service in terms of research, documentation. I just want to read you a paragraph or two because it puts it in context.
Then let's get to the images, all right?
What?
And then we'll get to the images.
We'll get to the images,
all right?
Because it has to do with the origins of who we are and why this place, Mars, is worth fighting over. He begins. To get a better understanding of the reasons behind the catastrophic events that took place on September 11th and thereafter, we must retrace the beginnings of this conflict, which is ancient, and find its beginnings in the heartland of what was once the splendor of what the Greeks called Mesopotamia. The main focus of this ancient and enduring rivalry falls at the feet of the Sumerian Empire. The Sumerian culture was located in the land of Sumer, which is now the modern-day Iraq. Iraq is an Arabic word, George, meaning origin.
Yes.
At its height, the Sumerian Empire extended from the tip of the Persian Gulf, from what was now Kuwait, including the lands between the Tigris and Euphrates, stretching across the great deserts to the shores of the Mediterranean Sea. scholars hail this area as being the cradle of civilization. This claim is supported by many archaeologists who believe the Sumerian tablets possess the oldest text of recorded history and may even hold the very key to our human origins. These ancient texts were recorded on clay tablets and cylinder seals, written in a cuneiform and pictographic script. The first researcher to make great strides in the decipherment of these cuneiform texts was the German scholar Grotefend in 1802. Once these tablets were deciphered and scholars began to study and translate highly detailed creation myths in the late 1800s, a whole new perspective on the history of man began to take form. As a result, many of the traditionally held views of world history began to be challenged, and a silent search for additional tablets soon followed. For the first time, both clergy and scholars, along with the leaders of the Western world, had to ask themselves two questions. Who were these Sumerians, the ancestors of the Iraqis, and where did they come from? Historically, the Sumerian civilization just appeared, amazingly, out of nowhere, as a fully formed culture. They built immense pyramids called ziggurats that rival the pyramids of Egypt. They developed a highly evolved written language and possessed great knowledge of science, astronomy, and mathematics. They developed the first wheel, perfected agriculture and irrigation, built the first cities of monumental architecture, and fostered a lineage of kingship. If that wasn't enough, the Sumerian myth supposedly claimed that man was created by a group of gods from another planet, whom they called the Anunnaki. The Anunnaki were known as the Nephilim in the Genesis story in the Bible, and on and on and on. In other words, I think, George, that this is archetypal. I think this is where the rubber is meeting the road, and I think a lot of this audience, who have been used to for so many years at being at the cutting edge and asking the crucial questions, need to be demanding answers tonight as to why we're doing what makes no sense in a very dangerous world.
It makes no sense, and they haven't really properly told us. And with this North Korean case coming up the way it has, it makes it even stranger.
Yep. George, how proficient are you with the web?
I'm getting very good these days.
Okay. Can you go to the Enterprise website?
I
want to take a little detour before we get to the stuff.
Okay, I will do that. Let me do some clicking here.
Lex Luthor, it's terrible.
You know what? I did that the first time I talked with him. I felt like I was from a Superman movie. Okay, I'm into the Enterprise mission.
Okay. What you want to do is you want to scan down.
Okay.
I'll give you a rough clue. You want to go down to 9502. The date's on the left.
Mm-hmm. And you've got a whole bunch of them there.
Yep. Okay. Just keep going down. You'll see 90502.
Yeah.
And it's the Enterprise mission Cydonia IR analysis. That's the title.
There's two of them there.
Yeah. Well, you want the first one.
All right. Click that on.
Yep.
Okay. And it's up. Ghost Town in the Darkness.
Yes. Exactly.
Okay. All right.
Now it should load for you fairly quickly. You have a broadband, I presume.
Yes, I sure do.
All right, you see the image at the top?
I've got broadband. No, it's loading, but it's still loading pretty slow. You're getting slammed again.
Uh-oh.
You are getting slammed.
Uh-oh. And tell me when you got an image.
I got the type, Ghost Town in the Darkness, and I've got the Neil Armstrong quote.
Okay.
And I've got Shakespeare's quote, but I don't have an image.
Okay, the image will come.
Okay.
What I want to show you to lead into the other images that we have over on the Coast website, which hopefully will be a little more robust.
Well, they're there, and I've seen those. Yeah.
What?
I've seen those on the Coast website.
Okay.
They're up.
What this image is the fusion between the IR image that was released this summer and the visual images that were released early in the spring by the Odyssey spacecraft, the Mars 2001 Odyssey spacecraft, which is currently orbiting Mars, with this incredible combination of a visual light camera and an infrared camera. And what we did was we got this bizarre image leaked to us out of somewhere. We're not quite sure where. It was on the ASU website. And Keith Laney downloaded it and proceeded to learn the processing steps and procure the software from Kodak, the Envy software. And between the two of us, we composited this visual image and the infrared image, and this is the image that so impressed and rocked back on his heels our mutual friend, Art.
Yes, I heard that show, as a matter of fact.
Has the image loaded yet?
Yeah, I have got one-tenth of the image. I've got about a quarter inch of blue at the top of where it should be. It's loading very slowly.
What we apparently see here is this ancient submerged city under the plains of Sidonia.
Okay, I have seen that before on your website.
Okay, well, then I will describe it as if you were still seeing it, and eventually you will. What is important about this image is that it gives solidity to all of the things that we have been claiming about Mars for all these years. What I found remarkable about Art's reaction was, of all the things I've shown him, this is the thing that really struck him in the solar plexus.
I remember his quote. I was driving home from, at the time, my local show, and I remember him saying, "Oh, my God, Richard. Oh, my God."
A lot of people have. Now, what people don't know, people in the audience, is that we have run this data by some very esteemed world-class remote sensing professionals in infrared space technology. And they have responded, and we're going to be publishing an article shortly on this, with an analysis. We didn't tell them where it was. We just told them the types of technology, the kind of camera that took the image, you know, the altitude and stuff like that. And they have responded with essentially our response, which was we're looking at structures under some kind of covering via a luminance layering visible light image over the infrared, which reinforces the pattern, the geometric pattern of the structures we see down there, and that this, in fact, is the remains of an ancient and now obviously abandoned Martian outpost of civilization.
How deep do you think this area is submerged, under whatever it's submerged under?
Well, initially, based on the laser data, we thought it had to be very deep. The other spacecraft, not Odyssey, but the Mars Surveyor, carries a laser, which is pinging the surface, or it was up until it quit. It no longer is functioning in that mode. And, you know, you basically measure the time delay. You measure the echo.
Right.
And
yeah.
It's like radar. Or, you know, you used to stand, you know, in a city and you would shout, you know, hello, and then you wait for the echo to come back. Or you see the lightning flash and you time how many seconds it is till you hear the thunder. The basis of all these echo measurements are assuming, you know, the velocity of the carrier of the information, be it sound or be it electromagnetic radiation, be it light. And if you know the speed of light and you send out a pulse from orbit, you can measure the time delay between your ping and when you hear the echo of your ping, or you detect it in your telescope. So that's the basis of the laser altimetry of Mars, because they basically are producing profiles. Every time the spacecraft would orbit over a piece of Martian real estate, they would get a profile continuously around one orbit. I forget how many million pulses, you know, were delivered in a two-hour orbit, but it was a lot. And think of these as little dots, and each dot has a height, and you put them together and you get a basic contour map. And if you put enough of them together, it's like winding twine around a ball, like your grandmother used to when she used to knit sweaters or socks.
Yeah, that's all she did, was make this huge ball.
Well, she had this ball, and she would take the twine off, and it would come off in a, you know, it's wrapped around in a kind of a pattern. Well, think of the orbit of the spacecraft as making the pattern, and the light pulses as stitching the surface and making a map of the ups and downs and valleys and crater rims and whatever, and that's how you get profiles of the surface of Mars. And they've been doing this now since 1997, when that spacecraft got into orbit. So we've got a fairly complete map of Mars with a resolution of a few meters in the vertical sense and about 100 meters in the horizontal sense.
Now, if I remember, though, this picture was sent to you, but They don't know who sent it, right?
This was downloaded by Keith Laney on the second night, on August 25th.
All right,
July 25th.
Okay, it's starting to, now it's slowly starting to come out here. I'm about a third of the way down.
Okay, so you've got the top of it.
Yes.
And you can see this geometric stuff with the red colors and the other colors.
Yes, yes.
And it looks for all the world like you're looking at a city building with vertical relief and perspective viewed from a great height.
Yes, it's true. It's got geometry to it, symmetry.
Incredible geometry. Now, this has freaked out our enemies. I mean, do you know that there are websites that actually have threads now saying, is Hoagland a fraud, all based on this image?
Hmm.
I mean, these people need to get lives. They really need to get another set.
Well, they don't believe in what this picture is.
Don't believe, but some are obviously agent provocateurs. Some are put out there to deliberately, shall we say, disinform people, the undecided in the middle, who might look at this picture and say...
You don't think that would happen, do you, Richard?
Yep. That was not a serious question, I take it. No, of course there's, you know, if they've been hiding as much as we believe they've been hiding, for as long as they've been hiding it, if we're going to war with Iraq, not because of weapons of mass destruction, but because of some secret agenda having to do with the Anunnaki and the Sumerians and the beginning of human civilization and the human origins on the planet Mars, of course they're going to be out there trying to cut us off at the knees because they dare not have too many people take this seriously.
If this picture is authentic, what kind of range are we talking about here? I mean, am I looking...
Or laterally.
Laterally. How far across is it?
Oh,
how many?
It's only a few miles wide.
Oh, that's all. Okay, so this is a pretty darn close picture.
This is on the upside of human scale stuff. I worked the numbers out with Ron Nix, one of our geologists, one night. And we're looking at things like the big Boeing plant in Everett, Washington, which is the biggest building in the world. It would be one of these buildings, all right?
All right.
The Pentagon would be one of these buildings. The vertical assembly building, I'm reminded when Jim Webb was showing President Kennedy, you know, this developing architecture at the Cape where they were going to send the moon rocket to the moon someday, which he, of course, didn't live to see. And he was in the back of the Cadillac, and they were kind of going through the swamps, and he grandly pointed over in that direction. He said, Mr. President, and there is our vertical assembly building. And, you know, Kennedy had this very impish sense of humor, and he looked at Jim Webb, head of NASA, and he said, Jim, how exactly do you assemble a vertical? Henceforth, it became the vehicle assembly building.
With the way Kennedy, I could just see him.
Vertically, they would stack one stage on top of the other, and that's where the initial name came from.
I do a great Kennedy impression, too,
by Kennedy was... it's too bad he didn't live to see everything that he had wrought, because we owe him an enormous debt if we can get out from under the scoundrels who have basically stolen everything he dreamed for us.
No, he'd say something like so.
So the thing
back to the image.
The city-like things, the geometry, the familiar landscape that looks like an urban scape is human scale, on the upside of the curve of human size things.
Why are some spots this reddish purple and then most of it is blue?
Okay. What we did is we compounded together the infrared image, which is, of course, in false color, and the red corresponds to certain materials. All right? The colors correspond to stuff, composition. And we did that with a black and white visible image. It's called luminance layering. And there's ample evidence of it being used both in the astronomical community, in the remote sensing community, in the secret, the spy satellite community. It's a way to basically combine different data sets to give you a synthesized overall picture.
You know, whatever it is, Richard.
It's a visual image which has also composition data. Now, we don't know what the colors correspond to, but we don't need to. All we have to do is to see that they're not everywhere, and they correspond to certain structures, and they don't correspond to other structures, which, of course, is the way architecture works here on Earth.
If you were to put something under ice, that's what it would look like. Whatever it is, it would have that kind of
blurry,
wavy look to it.
Recognizable form, except we've gone a long way from where we were in our analysis of this image back in July, and we're about to publish a much better analysis. And I frankly don't want to give away some of our surprises, because what we have come to realize about the image, which has bothered so many people, is that this stuff is not anywhere near as deep as we initially thought based on the laser ranging data.
What was the initial thought? How deep?
Several thousand feet.
Ah.
Underneath the surface. And everybody said, oh my God, Hoagland, the laser, you know, at 1.6 microns can't go through that, et cetera, et cetera. And they were right. They were absolutely right. But we have figured out how the laser has been fooled. And that in and of itself is a really cool scientific detective story, which we will maybe talk about on another show. By about that time, we'll probably have this thing ready. But we firmly believe that this data is real, that we were slipped something extraordinary to give us a window as to what the inside guys are seeing that the great unwashed, as they view all the rest of this, are not allowed to see. And the furor and the shrill screaming and the gnashing of teeth and the awful names that they call those of us doing this, Lanny, myself, and others, and the absurdities that are promulgated all over the web in desperation, in shrill desperation, is evidence, is quiet evidence that we're on the right path. So we fully intend to keep on keeping on.
How close is this region to Cydonia?
It is Cydonia.
It was right there.
The object on the left. You see that geometric triangular-looking thing on the left with the red on the bottom of it?
Sort of. I've only got half of the picture now.
Okay, well, let me scroll up and see. You got about half. Yeah, it's just, it should be just at the bottom. The object on the left. You see the triangle?
No, the I just see the tip of it.
Oh, you don't have half of it at all then?
Yeah. Then I probably got about...
Well, that's the fort.
40%. Okay.
That is the fort. And the face is off to the right. Anyway, the reason that I wanted you to look at this, and now we can go to the Coast website.
Get us to that. We're going to come up to the break in just seconds here. So
okay.
Let's get everybody
to the Coast. We'll set them up for what we're going to talk about.
Okay.
We're
going to
talk about a demonstrable set of exquisitely interesting and perplexing NASA lies about something which is so obvious you would think that it's the last thing they could lie about. And it became the first thing, and that is, what is the real color of the planet Mars?
Which, quite frankly, what I'm looking at looks like I'm looking at the planet Earth, Richard. That's weird.
Are you looking at? Are you looking at number one, I hope?
I'm looking at number one and two. I'm going back and forth.
Okay.
We'll be back with more. Richard C. Hoagland, my guest. Boy, there's a lot of stuff out there near Cydonia, isn't there? Whoa. Don't go away. Amazing pictures. Amazing. Where'd you get these?
Sources. And I mean, a lot of them are just public domain. And what we'll do is we'll lead everybody through this. Let me tell you some history of how this came about. We have published in the last month on our website, enterprisemission.com, a two-part article. I think you told me tonight it was 25 pages.
Yes.
Yeah, because you read it.
I have read it. I've got it right in front of me.
Excellent.
It's like a little book.
Well, it's the beginning of a series that we're going to do because, you know, you have to document specifically these extraordinary claims. And that's what this article does. It documents the claim by many people over many years that NASA has deliberately and with careful forethought and knowledge distorted, if not altered radically, the colors of the images of Mars it has presented to us from various spacecraft missions going back now, you know, some 25, 30 years.
Because if somebody doesn't check, whatever they give us is what we think, that's what it is.
Well, see, that's the problem with the space program. You are beholden to one agency, And that's why the Europeans, the ESA announcement that they're going, even if we aren't, is so extraordinarily interesting. Because it means that maybe, just maybe, on the eve of this insanity with Iraq / Sumer, people around the planet are beginning to realize that there's another set of agendas, that something else underground is driving the system, and it is not at all as it's being portrayed on CNN. And this idea that the Europeans are claiming that they're going, even if we're not, is, to me, throwing down the gauntlet. It's a clear message to those inside that their time is limited, and they have to decide what they're going to do.
Well, Richard, I didn't even notice if the Europeans even invited us to go with them. I mean, this is a trip without us.
Well, they've got the money. They've got resources and technology and genius and experts, and you know, they're leaving this year with an unmanned mission, the so-called Mars Express, which, you know, technology and God willing, will land a little robot on the planet called the Beagle, the Beagle 2.
Yes.
Which is a micro-miniaturized, sophisticated sniffer, sampler, digger, looker, which will land on a place on Mars quite far from any place we've ever looked at before and report back all kinds of cool and very important things about the environment, but not through NASA's eyes. It will be through a totally separate set of decision makers, governments, the European Space Agency, and from what you've been saying tonight and what they've announced, there appears that they've got the bit in their teeth.
Oh, they do.
My model is that all the in guys know exactly what's there, and everybody has been waiting for the right time to begin the process of telling the rest of us. And the process is predicated on a timeline. There's a clock ticking, and the clock has to do, coming back to what we found out, with these stupid rituals, that things have to happen in a season. Remember that great song, "To Everything There Is a Season"? Turn,
oh, yeah. Turn.
Yep. Well, it's very hyperdimensional, the turning part anyway. The fact is that this appears to be part of the clock. It appears to be part of the unveiling process. It's almost as staggering as the Skeptic Society's Michael Shermer the other day giving a positive review to a UFO documentary, if you can believe it.
I don't believe it, but you're right.
And coming on the heels of Spielberg's Taken,
yes,
you know, 4 years, 20 hours, he could have made it 19.4.
Well, and how about the British revealing some of their UFO reports all of a sudden?
For the first time in many, many decades, yes. All of this is looking, if you put it all together, as if, you know, Steve Bassett, my you know, friend in Washington who ran for Congress on the UFO ticket,
mm-hmm,
you can believe. You know, I would love to do a show with Steve some night.
He had some guts.
He actually got down and dirty in the vineyards and tried to bring these issues to the ordinary American electorate. And the stories of what happened and how he was treated by the press and by the mainstream and by ordinary folks is a very compelling story, and I would like to be part of that program if you ever want to do something.
Okay, and Steve has been a dear friend of mine, Richard, over the last several years.
Well, Steve, of course, and I have had this long conversation about when is disclosure with a capital D really going to take place. And there's a lot of our critics who say, oh, you guys have been claiming it's happening for years and nothing's going on. Well, you got to know how to read the tea leaves, George, and you were
sure,
very perceptive in bringing up at the top of the show tonight the Europeans' very firm stance about going with us or without us. That, in the circle of power that we're talking about, is fighting words, as they used to say.
Absolutely.
It means there's an ultimatum on the table, and even though we're the 800-pound gorilla, they feel they can go it themselves. What is going on in the back halls of power?
I've never seen anything like this before. Surely you would at least, throw the invite to the United States and say, hey, we're going to do this together.
Well, remember
it's not
the Russians a few months ago after they had the World Space Congress in Houston?
Okay.
Came out with a very remarkable statement. The head of the Russian space program, whose name escapes me because it does, I mean, come on, it's quarter after two here in Mexico, He made a very weird statement. He said, it does not look as if NASA is ever going to go to Mars. And that was followed, I mean, that came on the heels of a lot of Russians that for some reason, when they wanted to get visas to come and attend and give papers at this Congress,
right. They
were not allowed in the country.
Huh.
Now, you know, Bush is entertaining Vladimir down at the ranch in Crawford, and there's a whole story in Woodward's book about those meetings and how Bush decided to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty against the advice of his advisors, particularly Don Rumsfeld. And at the same time, his State Department is refusing visas to the Russians who want to come over here and talk about cooperation in space and going to Mars. So it's looking like the Russians and the Europeans in this great poker game in the sky have basically seen NASA and have raised NASA, and we're going to find out if NASA's willing to call.
Well, they're holding a party, and we never got the invite.
Well, you know, realize that if the Russians go and the Europeans go, ultimately whatever administration is in power at that point is going to have to cave.
They have to.
The American people are going to want to go. Remember, tonight, one of the things I want to leave people with is that we're not helpless. In all of this, there are things we can do. And when we get through these images, you know, I'm going to talk a bit about probably in the last half hour of the things we can do. This is a very important year for us, everyone, to do some things. So let me get back to this article. I started researching the history of the color of Mars as presented to us by NASA. And if you look at the first image, this is a composite that I modified from one that was done by a friend of mine on the Enterprise conference, Jim Heald.
All right, so that's comparison number one.
Number one.
All right.
And what we have here are like 9 images from various missions. There's some Hubble images. There's Mars Surveyor, there's Global Surveyor, there's, I don't think there's an Odyssey image there, but there's a variety of images. And what's the one striking thing you notice about all these images, George?
Well, there's a couple. Number one, they're all different in color.
This is science?
How'd I do? Did I get an A on
that's
that
an
one?
A.
Thanks, Professor Hoagland.
This is, look, color with a CCD electronic camera through a telescope or with a spacecraft image is rigorously controlled. I mean, there are photometric standards. There's spectrophotometric standards. Mars is not a place where a lot changes quickly. But we've got images going from 95 to 97 to 98 to 99, right? And they're all over the map in terms of color.
Now, let me ask you a bizarre question. The pictures we're looking at, all these little pictures of Mars, is this supposed to be the same picture taken at different times?
No,
Mars, or is the planet doing its rotation? Okay.
It rotates every 24 hours, 37 minutes.
All right, so it's not the exact image.
Picture.
All right.
You'll snap a picture of this side or that side. Or no, this is just a random collection that Jim assembled that I kind of added to, and the most noteworthy thing is the thing you said. If you look at it, everybody, there are no two pictures that have the same color. Now, one of the key things of science is consistency, right?
Well, there's none on this.
No, and this is with the best and the brightest. A lot of these are Hubble images. Now, except for the varying distance, there's a vacuum between Earth orbit and Mars, all right?
Yeah.
You're not going to get greenish Mars, salmon Mars, orange Mars, you know, orange marmalade Mars. I mean, all of these colors are bizarre.
This green picture of Mars that you got here looks like the thing is laden with vegetation for crying out loud.
All right. Now, let's go to my control. What I figured out, and I figured it out even before NASA announced that this is what they were doing with their images, and we'll get to that in a minute.
And this is number two now, right?
Image number two. This is a series of images taken by a Portuguese amateur named Cidadão, who lives in a little town outside of the main capital of Portugal, and he has a 10-inch telescope. The mirror, you know, it's a reflecting telescope. It's 10 inches in size.
Okay.
Remember, the Hubble is almost 100 inches. So he has a telescope one-tenth the size of Hubble. And because of the way mirrors collect light, it goes by the area. That means that his telescope is basically collecting 1/100th as much light as Hubble. And with electronic CCD cameras, charge coupled device cameras, in 1999, which was a good year when Mars was pretty close to us, something like 50-some million miles away, he got this series of images. And what's stunning is that, A, they're all the same, right?
Yes.
They're all the same color.
Yes, they're all the same color. Uniform, all across the board.
And the color of Mars is, this is what the color looks like. In the article that I wrote, which is the Revealing the True Colors of NASA, I have a lot of historical data. And in there I have quotes from visual observers going back over a century as to what Mars, like Edward Emerson Barnard, who was a very famous astronomer in the last century and a century before that. And he described Mars as pale salmon in color with darker markings that at times had a tinge of blue or blue-green.
Which looks like exactly image number two.
What you see in these amateur images. Now, why am I so focused on the amateur astronomers? Because, everybody, to me, it's obvious they're the last bastion of honesty. With amateurs all over the world, with modern technology, and putting their images on the Internet, looking at Mars from Australia, from Africa, from the Far East, from Iraq, from Iran, from Pango Pango, from Florida, the same colors and the same things are seen. Yet, with one image, one agency, one telescope, the Hubble, as you saw in the previous, graph, you've got 9 different colors for the same damn planet.
How can that be?
Well, it can only be if somebody is trying to confuse everybody. Which brings us to image number 3.
Image number 3.
All right.
Color corrections.
Now, what we did is we basically did the same thing that NASA admits or claims that it did with its latest release color from the Odyssey spacecraft a couple of weeks ago in the early part of December, maybe a month ago. We took the Hubble image that came in 1997 from March 10th. That's the image on the left.
Yes.
And
that's the red image. Okay.
One of Ciudadio's 1999 images, we basically simply change the colors until the deserts match.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else falls into line. By the way, notice in terms of detail how good the amateur astronomer's image is compared to the Hubble image.
Well, that's true. Very, very crisp.
Now, this is kind of peculiar because this Hubble image is supposed to have been taken from orbit in a vacuum with a telescope mirror 100 inches across. The little image of Mars above it, on the right, taken by Ciudadio, it's only done with a 10-inch telescope. And yet the detail is almost as good. If I blow that up to the same scale, you would see, in fact, if you look at the article, you will see some of the images we did that with. They are almost as good as the Hubble. So have we been getting the full resolution images of Mars as well as the color correct? Raises some questions, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now, if you go further, go to image number 4.
Okay,
I went back and I actually read some of what Percival Lowell, who is the Mars guy. He established Mars Hill out west of me here in Arizona.
He was the canal guy,
It was actually Schiaparelli was the canal guy, but Lowell became very excited after his tours of the Far East. He came back to Harvard. And he said, basically, I'm going to switch careers. I'm going to be an astronomer, and I'm building an observatory. I'm going to prove there's life on Mars. That sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it?
Any relation to you, by any chance?
None.
Right.
But I would not be unhappy if there were. The point being that when he looked at Mars through the telescope, and there's another picture of Mars there, an amateur CCD image, this one taken by David Moore.
Yeah, now that one's a little foggy.
Well, but look at the color.
The color's the same.
Look at the color. Exactly.
Yeah, the color's the same.
Different technology. He's in Florida. It's very hazy in Florida. David Moore does some really good work, but notice that the dark areas are greenish looking. The light areas are salmon, but there isn't a lot of detail because Mars was a little far away and it was through a hazy Florida atmosphere. But read what Lowell said. He said, in looking at Mars, the resemblance of the Arizona desert's lambent saffron to the telescopic tints of the Martian globe is strikingly impressive. Even in its modelings, the one expanse recalls the other. And below the image, I've got a picture of the Earth taken from STS-55, which is of the Arabian Peninsula.
Yep.
And you can see that our deserts, as seen from space, are not crimson red. They're not the brilliant ochres we've seen on some of the NASA images. They're basically salmon and pinkish tinted salmon colors. Let's go to the next one.
Okay. Go there, go back to that.
Which leads us to the most interesting hoax or switch, if you want to call it, in history. I was at JPL in 1976 when we landed on Mars with Viking, and I remember vividly this set of images. About 12 hours after we landed, they gave us the first color image of Mars, which is the surface view on the left.
Which looks like it could be the desert on Earth.
Of Arizona, as Lowell said.
Absolutely.
And then a few hours later, at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they yanked that image and they gave us the one on the right, where everything had been tinted pink.
What's the reason, though, for tinting it? What are we trying to prove?
They had calibrated the image, and the initial blue sky and Arizona-looking desert was erroneous. It wasn't real. In fact, the son, the teenage son of one of the investigators on the biology experiments, Ron Levin, reports that when he went around and changed some of the monitors at JPL back to the natural color, because they turned the red gun all the way up, the head of the Viking project threatened him with expulsion from the lab if he continued to do that. And later we found out that none other than the NASA administrator, Dr. Fletcher, in 1976, when this blue image on the left first appeared, he apparently made a phone call to the head of the Viking imaging team, Dr. Thomas Much, who later fell off a glacier in India and was killed.
That was weird.
Mountain climbing many years later. He made a call to Dr. Much and demanded that the imaging team destroy the negative for the image you're seeing on the left. Now, in the article, I raised the question, why would the head of NASA want to eradicate history? Even if it was erroneous history and the image on the right is the real color, why would NASA be trying to erase the trail that they'd ever put out a blue sky image? It makes no sense whatsoever unless there has been, from the beginning, a concerted effort to make us believe that Mars is not as Earth-like as these images would suggest.
You're coming up to a theory, aren't you, Richard?
Let's go to the next one.
Well, we're going to go to the break. Then we're going to come back to the next
then
one.
Then we'll come to the next one.
I'm George Norrie, Richard C. Hoagland, my guest. Don't go away. Welcome back with my guest, Richard C. Hoagland. Okay, Richard, we want to go to number 6 now, right?
Yes, we do.
Okay, I'm on it right now.
All right, number 6 is very important because this is the first color image, natural color image, from the color camera on the Odyssey spacecraft. And what we've done is we've put the image that was released by JPL on December the 7th, which, by the way, is a ritual date. And we've composited it in this graphic with several other images. The top Mars image on the right, the full globe, that's another Ciudadio image from 1999. The image below that is a Hubble image to the same scale. Notice the color. Now, the square image to the left of the Hubble image is an image that was produced by Jim Heald, who is a carpenter in Florida. He is an amateur imaging processor. He's not paid by NASA, not paid by any high-tech companies. What he did was he went into the Odyssey archives in October when the first data dump was published in the PDS, the Planetary Data System, and he took the raw data because we had all wondered for like over a year. I mean, the Odyssey arrived in October of 2001. It's been in orbit since October 2001. That's over a year. It has this incredible color camera. Would you believe that NASA didn't give us a single color image for a year, over a year?
Yes,
so
I believe that.
October of last year, a full 2 months before NASA finally gave us a seamless color image from the Odyssey mission, Jim Heald, a.k.a. Woodlock, that's his screen name in the Enterprise conference, took the raw data and made a color image. In fact, his image was the kind of catalyst for me doing the article, because I looked at it, and I looked at the amateur photography taken through telescopes from here on Earth, and I said, oh my God, he's got it right. You'll notice that it's salmon color.
Yes,
with
it is.
It's a kind of a small scale. Our friend Lex tonight, the one thing he didn't do is to give us a high-res link. Hint, hint, Lex, for this.
Well, he's gay. Hey, you just threw this at him, and, you know,
well,
what,
yeah, we threw it at him as of 6 or 7 o'clock tonight.
Yeah.
Wait
a minute.
Is it coming
up? Wait a minute. He's got a high-res thing right there. It says click on. He's got it. I'm looking at it right now. There's a little... If you
refresh my screen.
You see where it says click here for high res image? Right next it says it's.
Okay,
it says
now the, I see it.
All right, click
okay.
That on.
Flex passes with flying colors.
Good, very good. Very good.
Anyway, if you click on the high res image and really look at this, you'll see that there's an amazing amount of detail in the Ciudadio image, in the Heald image, which is the square, or almost a square, it's more a rectangle. Now, look at the one up at the top left, the dark red one.
Yes.
That's the official color image they released from Odyssey, the first color image. It's as red as all the other stuff they've been putting out.
Yeah.
So what we did, the image on the right now at the top, is we simply went into the gamma correction in Photoshop, and we increased the gamma by about 2.1, meaning we changed the brightness curve. That's all we did. We lightened it up so that the midtones match the salmon-colored deserts of the amateur photography from Earth. And when you look at the detail, you'll see there is an amazing array of wonderful, subtle colors all over this famous image, including very interesting and provocative hints of green.
How about vegetation, Richard?
That's
everywhere.
What the green may imply. Because you asked me if I had a theory. Let's go to the next image, okay?
Okay, let's do that.
Why do I think NASA's doing this? This is now another series of amateur images taken when we're about as far by a guy named Don Peach, who I think is also in the American South.
All right.
Taken early this year, from February to March.
Yep.
When Mars was very far away, we were on the other side of the sun.
About a month and a half.
Look at the color of the light areas, the deserts, and the dark areas. Look at how salmonish the deserts are, as they should be, and how greenish the dark areas are.
There's no question about it that we're looking at a planet here that has some distinctive different colors, which obviously mean things are there.
Well, not only are there the colors, but the colors change. There is an historical record, which I go through in great detail in the article, about, you know, the seasonal changes on Mars that were reported by Lowell and many, many others and recorded photographically all through this century. You have waves of darkening that start out in each successive spring in each hemisphere, moving from the pole at about 30 miles per day toward the equator. And the early astronomers thought they were seeing, you know, vegetation changes.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the fall, things go in the opposite direction. You get this wave of browning where the darker green areas, the blue-green, turn brown or saffron color and become basically cinnamonish looking.
Maybe the vegetation dies. Maybe the vegetation dies off during this period.
That's the model. That's the theory. So then the question is, from the 50s and 30s and 40s and 20s when all this was going on, to when we got high-tech spacecraft and cameras and all kinds of super-duper, you know, electronic gizmos that can give us these images, why has the official record been going in one direction and the amateur record, let's go to our next picture because this is the one that I think is the capper, all right?
That's number eight?
Number nine. I'm sorry, it should have been number eight, but I marked it number nine.
Mine says equipment. So
yep.
That's not one.
Yep,
okay.
That's the one.
All right.
All right. This shows you the scale of what we're working with. In the upper left is the telescope that Ciudadio is using to take these pictures. A little 10-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope, and below it is one of his images. On the right is a major professional telescope on Mount Wilson, the 60-inch telescope, which was used to take the picture to the left of it in 1956 when Mars was as close as it will be, just a little bit further away than it will be this year. Notice again, by the way, that image was processed by JPL.
Ah, okay, and that's okay. why it looks red, right?
That's why it's red. These guys have a red fetish. They can't look through a telescope and see the real Mars. But here's a stunning opportunity. We have got, coming up in August of this year, as I said earlier in the program, Mars will be closer than it has been for between 75 and 73,000 years by a few hundred thousand miles, all right?
All right.
There is a stunning array of amateurs all over the planet who have telescopes and electronic cameras.
Including me now,
software. And what I want to do is to challenge them to come up with the best damn amateur images of Mars. And what we're probably going to do in Enterprise is raise the money through our extraordinary support, this audience and others, and we're going to give a prize to the amateurs who give us the best real color images of the so-called red planet.
Am I allowed to enter this contest?
Absolutely.
All right.
Anybody with a telescope, I mean, you can now take a Coolpix, one of these, you know, commercial digital cameras.
Oh, sure.
Hold it up to the eyepiece of a telescope and get a hell of a good picture of Mars.
I didn't know you could do that.
There's all kinds of cute ways, and we'll probably publish something, you know, limiting out for people that don't know how to do this.
Yeah, give us some instructions.
Get the picture.
Okay.
But the real ones that are probably going to win the prize will be somebody who's been at this a little while or someone who has a fanatical devotion to learning. The point being that...
Or unless you tip the scales for me, for example.
If they've been lying about something as simple as the color, what else have they been lying to us about?
Why would they lie about the color?
Because if Mars, and this goes back to the whole Sumerian, Iraqi, Saddam, George ritual model, if there has been a literal transference of human beings from Mars in an incredibly distant era to the Earth, refugees who came from a dying civilization, and we don't have time, obviously, to get into why it died tonight, and there were records preserved of that transfer, that we are Martians, and a select few have had access to those records, have held these sacred texts as the most precious documents at the core of their being, because they're documents that go to the heart of the origins of the human race itself. And if these people, self-appointed priests, you know, have formed a religion around this knowledge, obviously it would only be bequeathed to a chosen few. It wouldn't be for the many. It would be for the insiders, for the elites, for the guys that somehow think they're better than the rest of us and that they deserve to know and we don't.
What an assertion, though, Richard. Unbelievable.
Well, but it's an assertion that's backed up by the evidence. Here we have a public agency. We have given them literally trillions of dollars. In the 40 years that NASA has been in operation, if it's averaged, you know, between $5 and $15 billion per year for 40 years, how much money is that? That's a
lot
of money.
Too much. Too much.
It's a lot of money. Now, it's not as much as the Defense Department has had in the same period of time, but it's not chump change. It's a reasonable amount of money. They have used that money to build the most exquisite facilities on or off the Earth. One of them is in orbit above us right now tonight. It's called the Hubble. I've demonstrated to you that Hubble can't take the same damn picture of Mars twice in a row. And the amateurs from all over the world with picky equipment look at the comparison between...
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Maybe Hubble can take the same picture. Maybe that's not what we're seeing.
Exactly. That is my thesis. And then that raises the question, why have they lied? Why did James Fletcher tell Tom Mutch, you know, 30 years ago, to destroy the blue sky negative that was returned by Viking on that first afternoon? To destroy an historical document makes no sense unless you're running a cover-up. So why would they want to lie about the color? Well, because for most people looking at this, most people reading the article, the most approachable aspect of Mars, as with any other planet, is what does it look like? I remember standing there at JPL, and I was with some pretty nice company, you know, some of my colleagues in the press, CBS, NBC, ABC, and Carl was with us, Carl Sagan. And he was standing there looking up in that beatific way that he had of looking at life and space.
Yeah, yeah.
And he looked at the color image coming in on the monitor, and he said what everyone else of us said as we saw this image come in. He said, it looks like Arizona. Now, if that's the real Mars, if that's really what it looks like, then it raises some even more interesting questions, such as the physics of how you get blue sky on a planet where there is supposed to be almost no air. Remember, the atmospheric pressure on Mars has been related to us now is 1/100th of the pressure of the atmosphere we're breathing right now. Doesn't matter what it's made of, it's the pressure which determines the color and the lightness of the sky, George, without dust in it.
Yeah.
If, for instance, they have lied about the pressure, I mean, all we have to go on is their data, right? Because from Earth, astronomers for 200 years before the NASA missions reported that Mars had about 1/10 the surface pressure of the Earth. During the space age, suddenly this number was revised down by a factor of 10 to where it would be inhospitable, uninhabitable, unbreathable, unlivable. Suppose that's a lie.
It could be the other way.
Find out. Well, one of the other things we're going to do this year, as Mars comes closest in August of this year, is you see that telescope there on the right of the last graphic?
Yeah.
The big 60-inch?
The great big one, sure.
That is available.
It's like an Erector set.
That is exactly. That is available for a price to any amateur astronomer on the planet.
How much?
Well, that's what we're in the process of finding out.
You mean to rent? You can rent it by the hour, maybe.
And what we're going to do is to raise some funds from our dear folks in this audience. You know, whatever you want to send Enterprise, this is the year we're going to make some very important things happen. And whatever you want to send us, we will gladly and gleefully accept. And I want to thank all of those of you who in the last year have supported us so nicely and so well and so diligently, because you, in fact, have made the difference. You have been the folks that have kept Enterprise going and alive. So if you want to continue, one of our projects is going to be to rent time on that telescope to aim it at Mars and to look at things like composition and the density of the atmosphere and the presence or absence of water vapor. Because remember, all of the readings and all of the pronouncements and all of the press releases that we are given are flowing from these official sources that in one way or another are beholden to NASA, an agency that demonstrably, with the color, can't shoot straight. So
I mean,
if you want to send us a few shekels so we can rent time on this telescope, which I think goes for a few thousand dollars a night, you can send it to Enterprise Mission, P.O. Box 3550, Edgewood, or it used to say Edgeworld, Edgewood, New Mexico, 87015.
Is that on your website also?
3550, Edgewood, New Mexico, 87015.
Is that address on your website as well?
On our website.
All right.
Well publicized. And as I said, what I'm planning to do is to take the modern tools, the democratization that the computer revolution has now given to the amateur astronomy community, and hold NASA's feet to the fire by doing independent science, real observations, to test these basic fundamental questions. what is the atmospheric pressure on Mars? What is the composition of the atmosphere on Mars? Is there water vapor? For instance, a few years ago, there was a very famous Harvard astronomer named William Sinton who thought in the late 50s he had found organic signatures in the darker areas of organic molecules. Well, a couple of years later, they published papers refuting it, and ultimately he caved in. The question has always been, why did the third observation that he made never get disputed, and why did he give in so easily? Was it perhaps that they made him an offer that he couldn't refuse?
You never know.
When you're talking about origins and destiny of the human species, did we really come from the fourth planet? Has someone tried to obscure our history to the level that they have been consistently lying to us about the most fundamental, easily tested observation, basically the color of the planet? If they've been doing that, and as you see, George, there's a very strong case that they have, what else have they not leveled with us on?
This is, I'll tell you what, I can't wait to see these pictures, Richard, when this planet gets that close and do a comparison, because the difference between what you showed us and what NASA is showing us is night and day. It's remarkable.
Well, we don't need a space mission. We don't need a space telescope. We just need access with current technology to the best telescopes on the planet, and we can get to those, and all it takes, literally all it takes, is a few dollars. Is it not worth the price to find out?
I sure hope so. Richard, let's keep in touch. We're going to get you back on again.
Thanks, George. And I guess we got through our first hour or 4 hours without our friend.
We sure did, didn't we?
The new year.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, George.
Well, for Stephen Carr, Dan Galati, Tom Denheiser, Lisa Lyon, and Barbara Simpson, of course, these are the people who helped me put Coast to Coast together, and many, many more. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there, I'll see you on our next edition of Coast to Coast, which will be open lines.